Welcome to the Arts and Antique Radio Show, where your host, nationally recognized certified appraiser Elizabeth Stewart, Santa Barbara's treasure sleuth, will help you put a value on the treasures in your own home.
Every time it rains, pennies from heaven. Don't you know each cloud contains pennies from heaven?
So let's find out. How valuable is it?
Hello, 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 Santa Barbara. It's your chantress of everything valuable and beautiful, Elizabeth Stewart. And I've spoken with Steve Grimmett before and was really impressed with his background. And then I got an email saying that he was going to present a film noir series at the Ojai Art Center Theater. Of which he's on the board. And I was thinking, wow, this is a cool opportunity to talk with a filmmaker who's going to curate 12 of his favorite film noir films. And I'm a film noir lover. Good. My favorite, oh, absolutely, Steve, my favorite not Marilyn. What's the name? The M lady's name.
Martha
Ivers.
Yeah, you said that in your email, right?
Love that series with that. Yeah, The Strange Love of Martha Ivers. Right. Yeah, and that's on your list.
That's Barbara right. It's number one. We opened the series with that one.
Good show. So Steve is a long time genius in his field. He's pioneered the field of computer and video special effects. And if you can remember back to War Games, that was the first time we saw Steve's work. And, you know, when you, do you remember, dear listener, when you go in, and it's like, okay, now I know that is computer generator because I see the flicker. So yeah. Steve figured out a way to eliminate that. What year was that, Steve?
1983.
Okay. So far back, 83 now.
I know. It's amazing. 43 years.
And so anyway, he then went on to do a movie, Sneakers. And he shot the second unit video in addition to carrying out, being the TA on that. The technical director, TD. And so then he co-produced and edited The Magic Machines. And that won the Academy Award as the best live action short subject. Now that was in
1970. Mm-hmm.
And then Stephen Elizabeth Grimmett did Birth of Ludi, Afternoon with Gregor Piatigorsky, Bright Tempest, The Art of Jesse Allen. And it went on as far as some of his more art films are concerned. But he's won many, many medals, entered many film competitions. And I don't know exactly why he ended up in Ojai, but we'll find out. Some of the movies that he's been involved with over the years makes him such a great person to do this sort of retrospective. So we're having this retrospective noir series of evenings, and they're going to run Sunday evenings. So what you can do is you can run out for dinner and then show up at 7 p.m. at the Ojai Art Center Theater. And every week of 12 weeks, you're going to see a different film noir show. And the presentation is called Shadows and Secrets, a film noir series. And then it's going to actually be focused, dear listener, on the more rare, the more restored and recovered films. You know, the things that we didn't see or we only saw bits of or we saw insufficient copies of. And you know what's even better? We're going to see this in the dark with other people. It's not going to be on our screens. It's not going to be that small. It's going to be on a real screen. In the dark with fellow film lovers, and people are going to clap and they're going to actually understand that there's other people watching at the same time. And there's a whole different vibe to that.
Very much, yes.
Then, you know, laying in bed watching something. Okay. I'm showing Steve my phone. So let's talk a little bit, Steve, about film noir. I think it didn't start in America. Was it Italy?
Well, no, it actually did start in America. What happened was that I'll go back in a moment about the history of film noir, but as far as where it started, it definitely is an American movement. It wasn't even a movement. It was recognized as a genre in the late 50s by French critics who looked back at the recent couple of decades, the 40s and 50s, and noticed that there was a trend to make very low-budget films that weren't taken very seriously. They were what were called B pictures at the time, filler between the A films that had the featured the higher paid star. Well, actually, the stars pretty much all got similar salaries at the time because they weren't free agents. They were under contract to the studios. But the studios would put out a number of what were called A movies that had budgets of roughly around $1 million. And in between those, they would shoot quickie B pictures, and sometimes using the same actors and same crew because they were all on staff. And so even though the budgets were lower and they had to shoot them more quickly, the quality was amazingly good because they used the same great cameramen and sound people, and some of the A-list actors would also appear in them. Let me ask you a question.
Sure. So these are the French film critics that are realizing a genre, right, and they're piecing together the elements of this genre. But you're saying it's not an American?
No, I'm saying it is. It's definitely an American movement. The film noirs were almost all made in America, but when they were being made, nobody had any idea that in 50 years later they would be taken seriously. They were mostly B pictures. That the fillers between the more profit, the ones they assumed would be more profitable and that they spent more money publicizing. And they were kind of fillers in between those pictures. And nobody assumed at the time that they would have any longevity beyond the few weeks when they were first shown. But the French, a group of French film critics in the late 50s started looking back at these films and realized, I got to turn that off. I'm sorry. That's a signal that's telling me when I get an email, and that could be happening.
But Steve, you know, the thing is, now you're saying that they were kind of like on the margins, that film noir was not considered to be the art form.
Right. When they were being made, they were thought of as cheap filler pictures that would be put out between the A films that they hoped would generate the most income, because they wanted to have something going all the time. They didn't have enough first rate, as they saw them, films to go on every week or two. So in between, the studios would shoot these cheaper films, which they didn't take seriously as great art. It was only a couple of decades later when some French film critics looked back at the American movies of the 40s and 50s and realized that some of these films that weren't taken seriously at the time that they were produced in Hollywood actually had great artistic merit. And there's some reasons for that, which I can go into as we...
I'd love to hear that, but I got a couple of questions. So this is an American art form, and you're saying that it was done sort of in between slices of A movies.
Right.
So it was like, okay, let's stick something here. We've got the set. We've got the actors.
Exactly. We have everybody under contract. So while we're getting ready to make the next A picture, let's shoot a few quickies because we have all these people on salary that aren't doing anything, including writers. And they would shoot them very quickly. Sometimes it is typically a budget would be maybe $100,000. Where an A film would have a budget of $1 million, and they would shoot them in about a week instead of 3 to 5 weeks or so that it would take to shoot one of the A films. And they used the same high quality technical people that were on staff to do the A film. So the quality technically was remarkably good. They were cheap because they were shot very quickly. They were sometimes completed in as few as 3 days. And then as far as what distinguishes them artistically, I can come to that. If you want, I can go right into that, or maybe you have some other questions.
I do have a few questions before we do it. Number one, you say they're quickies. Are they shorter in duration than the A film?
Well, they could be somewhat. The typical running time of an A film during that period was about an hour and a half. Now, over the years, that running time has gone up, so the average film today is around 2 hours or even a little more. But throughout the whole 40s and 50s, it was very typical for a film to be anywhere between an hour and a half and an hour and 40 minutes. And many of these film noir are that length, and some are shorter. Some are short as an hour and 10 minutes. So they're all between an hour and 10 minutes and an hour and a half.
So when you say that some of them were, they say quickies and shot in a shorter duration of time than an A film, am I wrong in thinking that, for example, that more was left to the actors in the way of improvisation, in the way of their own characterization? Or was this art form called noir as highly directed, as specifically direct, as tightly directed as an A?
That's a very good question. Well, there's no definitive answer for that, but I can tell you that because the same directors were used that were used on their A films, they tended to work in the same way, except because of time constraints. It is possible that, you know, they very rarely allowed any kind of rehearsal time the way you'd have in a stage play. The actors would come in presumably knowing their lines, and they would go over them a few times, and then they'd say, okay, we're ready to shoot. And though the actor would go to the dressing room while they were setting up the lights, and then they'd come back out and they'd shoot it. So they didn't have any real rehearsal time. And I would guess, I know this is just conjecture, but I would assume that even though they were using the same directors that would shoot an A film, where they had three or four times as long to shoot them, they may have taken a few shortcuts with the direction and just let them go more on their own. But I don't know the answer to that. I'm not sure it is known. I think that would really vary from one film to another and from one director to another.
I asked that because Scarlet Street is also a favorite of mine. And so that's the earliest one you're going to show in the series. That's 1945. And that is, you know, Fritz Lang's. And then the performance is Edward G. Robinson. And I was thinking, well, we can look at that 1945. That's really early on in his career. And we can say, oh, yeah, we can see where he's running with it more than it was maybe with a highly directed A film, you know, like what's the one with the, oh, gosh.
Well, he was in a lot of crime films that were.
Yeah.
Yeah, not that were made even actually before.
Double Indemnity, I'm thinking of.
Double Indemnity was made the year before Scarlet Street.
Was it? Okay, yeah. So we don't really have a bellwether for him to say, oh, yeah, he's definitely now on his improv game, as opposed to a more A series.
You know, I'm assuming, now this is a very good question. I would have to research it to give you a definitive answer. I don't think very much improvisation was generally
allowed.
Neither allowed nor preferred by the actors. I think they would make, because they didn't really have a lot of time. If you improvise, you never know what you're going to get, right? And they were shooting these, especially these B films, which became the heart of the film noir genre. They didn't really have a lot of time. I mean, they would sometimes shoot them in as few as 3 days, more typically a week. So I doubt very much that they would give the actors the opportunity to improvise. They would pretty much say, you know, we're ready to shoot this. You know your lines. Let's go for it. But a skilled actor like Edward G. Robinson would always give a very highly refined performance. It was just his ability. His ability was so pronounced and refined that he always gave a good performance.
Okay, so just another question now, because I'm always thinking of how film might echo other art forms of the period. And I'm thinking, were the period slightly before the noir films, and we have the noir novels and that subgenre of crime fiction.
Right.
And, you know, we've got,
Raymond Chandler.
Dashiell Hammett. We've got Raymond Chandler. Mm-hmm. We've got Patricia Highsmith, who I absolutely adore, Strangers on the Train. So we've got, you know, these great writers that are writing in the 30s and 40s that are sort of, are they almost, you know, and then we get some little later versions too when these movies are starting to really pick up. You know, we've got like Jim Thompson and some of these great writers. I'm thinking even some marginal writers where you have Dennis LaHaye. I'm thinking of other noir forms. And there's also the beginning at this time of street photography, you know, which is very dark, and the 30s and the 40s. So,
and we have an example of that actually in one of the films that we're showing called The Naked City. We can come to that, or I can go into that now if you'd like.
Naked City. Oh, yes. Okay. Yes. So you get that grit. So, but my question is, you know, in a lot of things where I'm looking at material culture and thinking of the crossovers between the style of writing, let's say, and the style of decor and the style of dressing and the style of still photography, its style of film, et cetera, there's a stream that runs through it, but it seems to start, I might be wrong, but it seems to start with the written word, doesn't it? Noir tradition?
Most of the film noir were based on stories written by some of those authors like Raymond Chandler and Dashiell Hammett. And they tended to focus on stories about what it was called hard-boiled crime stories, where they would focus on a policeman who was not made possibly totally or partially corrupt, or a private detective. But as far as the style, that actually goes back to the 1920s and German Expressionism.
Okay, there we go. Yep.
Yeah. And the reason that that got infused into the noir genre is that a lot of these great directors, especially from Germany, fled during the time between the two world wars, when a lot of them were Jewish and they knew they were already being persecuted. So they came to this country. Fritz Lang, whom you already mentioned, would be a good example of that. And there were others, and they brought their style with them. And that's where we get the thing that sets film noir apart. The most obvious difference between that and other genres is the way they lit the films. They use this is a term I know you're familiar with, chiaroscuro lighting, basically the lighting that was used in the paintings of Caravaggio in the hundreds of years before. And they did this in the 1920s to illustrate the disorder, psychological disorder and paranoia that they were feeling. They used a lot of dark shadows and highlights. And that became the style that these directors decided to use when they were hired to do film noir. Well, again, it wasn't called that, but when they were making these low-budget B films of the 1940s through early 50s, that same style was brought to bear with it. So there was both the directors and the camera people who were very fond of this technique that came out of German Expressionism. And that's where the visual look of noir comes from.
It's so interesting. So I was thinking of the written word because I was thinking, obviously, that some of the, you know, like Dashiell Hammett's Maltese Falcon and how that's later made into a film, et cetera. But I should have been thinking, I mean, that's my background. I should have been thinking about German Expressionism and its cousin, Surrealism.
Yes.
And so, you know, what you have is you've got like even Max Ernst, who's coming, you know, with Peggy Guggenheim, and he's a world citizen, et cetera. And he's bringing a certain brand of surrealism. And then I'm thinking of the real hard-bitten World War II German expressionist, Kathy Kollwitz, for example, who it is so black and white that it is, mm-hmm. it is so disturbing, and so much focus on that psyche being torn apart kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's where I should have gone. Is to that the visual vocabulary, not necessarily the narrative vocabulary. So yeah, that was a question I had for you, which is where this comes from. Yeah. And it but it comes from a certain that, you know, the movies that you're going to talk about, most of them are either they're right after the Second World War, which is totally devastated so many, I guess, souls and psyches anyway. And, you know, we went from the wartime films of escapism, and now we've got the noir films, which are a whole different kind of escapism that just is taking you down and down to go out, I guess you could say. And my question to this regards is, did the war affect any of the noir films? Did you get any sense of that desperation through the noir films in America?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it was the war during this movement began actually in 1941 with the film you already mentioned, The Maltese Falcon. That's generally considered to be the first noir, the first major one, the one that we all know about. And another highlight came 3 years later with Double Indemnity that you've mentioned before. But yes, as I say, it's all related because the Germans, who some of the key directors and camera people who came here escaping Nazism, that same paranoia and sadness and depression carried through the war years as well. So I would say that the subject matter and the way that it was executed was definitely related to the kind of depressed feeling that was prevalent throughout the world before and during and shortly after the war. And that's very much reflected in noir.
And, you know, you get the anti-hero then coming in at the same time. So so it's like the wartime films, both in England and in the United States, they're full of heroes. And there's not a lot of anti-heroes going on until we have like the end of the Second World War, where somehow the protagonist is flawed and desperate and usually male. You know, and
well, actually, that's interesting. Sometimes they start out as people whose flaws are not apparent, and they come out during the evolution of the story. And very often those flaws are brought out by the appearance of another staple, which is found in most, if not all, but many or probably most films of that genre, which is the femme fatale, the seductive woman who lures the man. She seizes upon his weakness and uses it to lure him to his doom. That's a very familiar theme in all of noir.
And I think about that, too. And I think about the propaganda posters. Every country that was involved in the Second World War, it had this. I have a client, Steve, who collects these. And it's talk about the femme fatale. I mean, you stay away from these women or you're going to get a disease or you're going to get worse. Yeah.
Right.
Then that disease, et cetera, et cetera. And so it's almost like the anima, you know, the anima is to be afraid of, is to be, you know, even some of the, like the imagery of the destroying goddess, you know, the Kali figure, the female that's the destroyer. You know, there's my clients got posters where, you know, you've got these sweet looking women, you know, who are carrying a disease, for example, that a soldier doesn't want to contract. And you've got females painted on bombs, you know. And so you've got a real issue, I think, during that time period with the Madonna horror complex going on at the same time. So, you know, this is, I think, as you say, the femme fatale is coming out of that.
Yeah, well, actually, there's a couple of different trends there. There's the pinup trend. During the war, the GIs, of course, didn't see very many women. And the women they did see were often prostitutes. So they idolized people like Betty Grable, and they would have her picture all over because they missed being around women. And that probably carried over to noir because a lot of the female protagonists, or maybe they weren't actually always protagonists, they were foils for the male lead, who was usually the protagonist. They would be nightclub singers. They would be very glamorous characters. And they would be the ones that would the men would become fascinated with and eventually wound up being partially responsible for the criminality that ensued. And in fact, my own personal look at this is that it was kind of convenient because most of these filmmakers were male.
Yeah.
There was one notable female whom I'll mention in a moment, Ida Lupino, but most of them were male. So it probably was something that fed into their own psyche that they would have males who were led astray, not by their own internal demons or weaknesses, but by the influence of a woman who dragged them down. I think that made it very convenient for them. They could use, well, I'm sure they weren't even aware of this, so I could be completely wrong. I'm looking at this from a 21st century perspective. But
I think that's very interesting as I think of, like, my parents are from Germany. And I'm thinking that my mother was, even though she was born in 1929, my mother, she always wrestled with the fact that it was Kirche. So you go to church and you're in the kitchen. So mm-hmm. that's about what women were.
Yeah,
and she
right.
wrestled with that. Mm-hmm. She was, you know, she was a brilliant pianist and she wanted to do more, but it was almost like the German sort of zeitgeist was, you know, you're going to be second to your husband. And she rebelled against that. And then she'd go back to it. She'd rebel against it, go back to it. So, yeah, I think there's here again, that's a Germanic thing. You're talking about all these beautiful directors. Fritz Lang, for example, coming from Germany. I got another question. So some of the noir films that you pick that I love, the city is a character.
Right.
An urban setting is a character.
Very much.
And that was sort of a different, I mean, was it a different way of looking at,
yes.
at the soul of a city?
Yeah. Well, in fact, I mean, the city plays a role in all of the ones that take place in an urban setting. But it was really focused on in one of the movies that we're showing on May 31st, The Naked City, made in 1958. Ah. They decided not only to feature the city as one of the characters, but to actually, instead of having just background shots of the city as someone were driving from one place to another, they took the main camera out into the city, disguised it by building a fake newsstand around it or some other way so that people walking by on the street wouldn't notice it. And they would shoot many of the screens actually on the streets of the city, not just the so-called B-roll, the background shots, but actual main scenes from the film that have chases going through the city. And a lot of the people that you see in those in the background are just regular citizens who happen to be on the street that day.
It's funny, too, when I think about the city having an underworldly color contrast, the chiaroscuro you're talking about. And then I think about, you know, He Walked by Night, in which, you know, the protagonist is going into the drain, mm-hmm. into the bowels, into the sewer.
Right.
Of L.A. drain system, you know, and it's his own hell. He's in the underworld. That's Orpheus. You know, he's in the underworld. Mm-hmm. And that becomes, I mean, so claustrophobic and so frightening that would even happen. You know, it is. That's what I beg the question. What does the city mean to the noir genre? The city is an important character.
Very much.
Is it ever a character that is a redeeming character, or is it always an evil presence, the city?
I can't think of too many films that would be considered noir where the city is a redeeming presence.
Yeah.
It's either a threatening place or just a very busy background that the filmmakers thought would be interesting to depict.
Is there ever a film that you can think of, or maybe that you're featuring on your pick of 12, that was more rural country set?
There are a few like that. There's one that I didn't pick that also features Edward G. Robinson called The Red House. I didn't pick that one. I may, if I continue this series, and I'm hoping to have films every Sunday night from now on. We're starting with 12 film noir, but I'm hoping to make this into a regular Sunday night event. And if I do that, there'll be many other films, not always noir. But if we do,
I vote for that. I vote for that. I think you'd be perfect for that.
Well, you know, for many years, for 15 years, I did all the programming for the Ojai Film Society.
Yes, how I know you. Yep.
Yeah, and which came to an end, as you know, in 2014, when speaking of storm drains, I guess it was a major water pipe broke under the streets of Ojai and flooded the theater and closed it for 10 years. And that kind of put the Film Society out of commission. Now they show movies in Libby Ball during the summer. But I think a lot of people really miss the Sunday afternoon films. So we can't use we can't do anything on Sunday afternoon at the Art Center because they have matinees there very often. But Sunday evening is free, and I think I may just continue this with various other kinds of films. But if I do another noir series, there's a good chance I will include some of the ones that were set partially in the city. There was one called Where the Sidewalk Ends. Mm. It starts out in the city, and because a cop keeps getting into trouble by beating up suspects, and they say, well, you can either get thrown off the force or we're going to assign you to a job out in the country. And the rest of it takes place out in the countryside. And then there's one called The Red House, featuring Edward G. Robinson, which is entirely set in the country. But most of them do focus on city settings and city life, I would say.
So is there one of your 12, Steve, or maybe you're thinking of the next series of 12, is there one of your 12 where the protagonist is redeemed somehow? Do they always?
Oh, yes.
Are they always doomed?
No, not always. Very often they are because, as you know, the Hays office, which was the censor of the day, had very strict rules. Some of them are actually comical. I can give you one example of that just as an aside, something that became legendary. Many of your viewers and listeners probably know about it, but they were so prudish, so afraid of offending anybody, that if they showed a scene of two people in bed, two people of the opposite sex in bed, at least one of their 4 feet had to be on the floor. And so, so that's the reason that whenever they depicted married couples in their own homes, they would always have double beds in their bedroom, which was very rare. You would find that in hotels, not very often in a person's home. I'm sure you would occasionally, but most married couples would share a bed, never in the movies, because that would mean that if they were both in bed at the same time, at least one of their 4 feet would have to be dangling over the side.
But in the case of the noir film, what did the Hays Code direct?
The code applied. Now, there's one interesting example. It's a film that I didn't show. I hadn't thought of it. I think if I do another series, it will definitely be included. It's called Pitfall. And it stars Jane Wyatt and Dick Powell, both of whom give really excellent performances. And that's a little different. It's a story about a regular citizen who gets seduced by a woman that he's investigating as part of a fraud that he's covering, trying to reclaim money from. And he has an affair with her. Now, this was something that you had to do very carefully. You could show people kissing all you want. That's another thing that's quite interesting. In modern movies, you see people hopping in and out of bed all the time. You rarely see people kissing. Well, kissing was the emblem that suggested sex during the period up till the late 50s, early 60s. So when two people got together and they were kissing, that meant they were having an affair. That's what it indicated. So when they weren't fighting and shooting or drinking and smoking, they were kissing. But in this one film called Pitfall, the censors were a little bit concerned about the fact that at the end of the movie, the character played
you said Dick Powell.
Dick Powell. Yeah. He convinces his wife, who finds out about it, to take him back. And the censors were concerned about this because they felt he hadn't suffered enough for having committed the crime of adultery. So the way the director, Andre de Toth, his name was, the way he dealt with this, he paid a visit to the Hayes office and talked to the censors. And he let them know that the two men that he was talking to both had, that he was aware of the fact that they both had mistresses. And once he made them aware of the fact that he knew this, he didn't try to blackmail them, obviously. He just dropped into the conversation the fact that he was aware of this. All of a sudden, their objections to the adultery vanished. So little tricks like that were played that you might say were a kind of mild form of, I wouldn't say
persuasion.
Yeah, persuasion. Mild extortion.
Mild extortion. Yeah.
But the rules were very, the reason you see so much drinking and smoking and kissing is that there was, they were very limited in what they could do. They couldn't even show extreme violence. They could show people having a fist fight. But if somebody were going to get struck with a blunt instrument, which is kind of a gruesome thing to watch, you would never see that. The camera would pan away and you'd hear it, or you'd see a person's hand coming up into the frame and going down. So they were very, very rigid in the kind of censorship that was imposed.
But you saw guns.
You saw guns everywhere, and you could see guns being fired, and you could see people being hit by the guns and falling over. That's right. But you couldn't see actual blood and gore.
We'll take a quick break. And then the high point of the interview for me is the clothes and the hats. I want to talk about the distinctive, the clothes and the hats, the suits on female slinkiness factor.
Oh yeah,
The clothes and the hats and the men's suits and the women's gowns. I want to talk about that. Go to a quick break. I want to reintroduce Steve Grumet is here because we are talking about a really special thing that's happening at the Ojai Arts Center Theater, and I'm hoping that Steve will continue this and do a regular Sunday night host gig. He's bringing us 12 noir films, his favorite 12 noir films, Strange Love of Martha Ivers, The Hitchhiker, Scarlet Street, Kansas City Confidential, The Naked City, Panic in the Streets, He Walked by Night, Woman on the Run, Too Late for Tears, The Prowler, Raw Deal, and The Big Combo. And he's bringing them all. I think they're all from the mid-40s to the mid-50s, about a 10-year time period. And so he's bringing them to start his screening. And it's going to be May 3rd through July 26th at 7 p.m. at the Ojai Arts Center Theater. Perfect time. You go get an early dinner and you come back, you see the films and you see it together with people, which is really important. Get off your screens and see it with people. So we'll go to quick break and then we're going to talk about my favorite topic, the style of clothing in film noir. So distinct, the hats even, you know, both
hats
on men
and the gowns.
And the gowns. Can't wait. Don't turn that down. Welcome back. It's Elizabeth Stewart. I'm speaking with Steve Grumet. He's bringing to the Ojai Arts Center Theater a series called Shadows and Secrets, a film noir series, 12 rare and restored. Some of them, of the pieces that your works of the films that you're going to see have not been seen in this condition ever. So Steve's bringing these 12 films to the Ojai Arts and it's starting every Sunday night. It starts May 3rd. And so this is a perfect opportunity with a master filmmaker, Steve, to see what he sees in the film noir that he's chosen and why he's chosen them. And I asked Steve to think about two things. Number one is the clothing in film noir, which I love, and the slinkiness of the gowns and the kind of straight, kind of suity looking stuff of the men with the hats, you know, the fedoras and mm-hmm. that kind of thing. And the ubiquitous cigarette, for example, suspenders, for example, you know, all these things. So I wanted him to talk about the clothing of the wardrobing of film noir. And then secondly, I want him to talk a bit about the narrative quality. So there's there seems to be in the noir films that I love, there's a narrator. It either, you know, it's William Holden in Sunset mm-hmm. Boulevard. He's narrating, you know, backwards look at his life and death, et cetera. But there's other omnipresent narrators in other noir. So those are the two. But let's start with clothes, Steve.
Okay, well, before we even get to clothes, I certainly want to talk about that and the use of voiceover narration. But I want to be, you touched on something that I want to emphasize because it's really important for people to know this. Some people hearing this may think, well, I've seen some of these films already. They're on the movie channel all the time. What's the big deal? Well, the big deal is twofold. And one of the things is exactly what you mentioned, that there's a very big difference between watching these at home. Even if you have a big screen TV, it's not like watching it on a 16-foot screen in the movie theater, surrounded by other people who are having the same experience with you. That's one thing. But the other thing is, and you also touched on this, all of these films have been restored recently. So the ones that you've probably seen, if you've watched them at all on television, are old prints that have been around, you know, around for a long time, have gotten beaten up, they're in bad shape, they're scratched, they may be, the image quality may be deteriorating. These have all been painstakingly restored to 4K video, a frame at a time. So they actually look better because they can remove the grain now with AI. So not only do they remove all the scratches and imperfections and all the shakiness that they may have had, but they can remove the grain. So when what you're seeing is it looks actually better than what people saw when they were first released in the movie
theater. Wow.
And they will almost never, the only way that they would ever have an opportunity to equally experience that we're offering them with this series would be if they went to one of the film noir series that are occasionally shown in theaters around the country. There's one in San Francisco. Occasionally, I believe they have one every year in LA. But aside from that, this will be their one and only opportunity to see these films better than they were meant to be seen.
Just a question. Where'd you get them?
I did a lot of research to find out which films were available in restored quality. There were some, like there was one film that I really wanted to show that I'm sure you will remember. It's been shown a lot on television, called DOA with Edmund O'Brien. It stands for Dead on Arrival. It was one of my favorites. I saw it when I was a child. I could not find a decent print, and I didn't want to subject the audience to something that was less than excellent. So I'm still hunting. I think I've heard rumors that maybe there are some prints of it available. Some of the films I'm showing were thought to be lost. One called Woman on the Run, people knew about it. They knew that it had been made back in the 40s. I think it was it 49? That one? I don't have, let's see here. Yeah, that was 1950. They gave it up for lost until they discovered that there was one print floating around. They finally got a copy of it, and they took it to the UCLA Film Restoration Department, and they restored it frame by frame. So what you see now is better than what you would actually have seen in the theater. So, and in other cases, it wasn't so much of a detective story to find a print, but they still had to do the painstaking work of restoring them, which is a very expensive process. And they won't do that unless they know that they can sell several thousand copies of it. And sometimes those were limited editions and you can't find them anymore. So to buy a restored Blu-ray disc, you have to pay a premium. But the bottom line is that I did a lot of research to dig these up, and every single one of these is a restored version that will look spectacular on the big screen.
Steve Grumet is here, because we are talking about a really special thing that's happening at the Ojai Art Center Theater. And I'm hoping that Steve will continue this and do a regular Sunday night host gig. He's bringing us 12 noir films, his favorite 12 noir film noir films. Strange Love of Martha Ivers, The Hitchhiker, Scarlet Street, Kansas City Confidential, The Naked City, Panic in the Streets, He Walked by Night, Woman on the Run, Too Late for Tears, The Prowler, Raw Deal, and The Big Combo. And he's bringing them all, I think they're all from the mid-40s to the mid-50s. Don't turn that down. Welcome back. It's Elizabeth Stewart. I'm speaking with Steve Grimmett. He's bringing to the Ojai Art Center Theater a series called Shadows and Secrets, a film noir series, 12 rare and restored. Some of them, of the pieces that your works, of the films that you're going to see, have not been seen in this condition ever. So Steve's bringing these 12 films to the Ojai Arts, and it's starting every Sunday night. It starts May 3rd. And so this is a perfect opportunity with a master filmmaker, Steve, to see what he sees in the film noir that he's chosen and why he's chosen them. So just to, before we launch into the costuming, the music. So there's that distinctive noir kind of backdrop music, which is usually a single horn, whether it be a saxophone or a trumpet. Very lonely, very, you know, it's in a minor key. It's sort of very sparse, you know, sparse scoring, et cetera. So has the music been restored as well on these films?
That's a very good question. That's a little bit harder. It's easier to restore the visual quality just by re-photographing the frame and using AI to improve it. Yes, technically, it would be possible to restore the quality of the sound to a limited degree. And I honestly, I don't know the answer to that question. That's something I should know, and I will check that out. I haven't, in the research that I've done, most of the restoration work that I'm aware of was visual, and I don't really know if they've addressed themselves to doing that. But I can tell you this, that when I watch movies on television, on Netflix or Amazon, I always turn up the subtitles, because modern movies, for some reason, even though they're technically excellent in many respects, they don't make sure that you can understand all the words. People mumble, they're turned away from the camera, their sounds are, their voices obscured by other sounds. I need the subtitles to know what people are saying. That is not true with the film noir, even though they didn't have magnetic recording until the mid-50s. So most of these are recorded with optical tracks, which are not nearly as good as the magnetic tracks that were used later. They were so careful about getting good microphone placement, having the actors speak up, that even though I do watch them with subtitles because I'm used to doing that, you don't really need them. So the sound quality in terms of the dialogue is superb. The music is, that is something I don't know the answer to. I haven't found them to be difficult to listen to, but whether they've actually been restored, I'm not sure.
Okay, so very quickly, let's talk, you know, your favorite, maybe your favorite suit,
your favorite
gown. Okay, well,
let's talk about the men's clothing first and then the women's clothing.
Okay.
Okay. The men's clothing, they didn't pay as much attention to making the men's clothing distinctive. The reason that you're seeing all the men wearing hats, which almost, it's almost funny in a way, because almost nobody wears hats anymore, unless they're baseball caps, maybe. And that's because people in that era did wear hats. All they were doing was reflecting what they saw around them. A man would feel half naked if he went out into the street without a hat. So that's the reason that all the men wore those fedoras. The reason that there was so much smoking was that smoking was very popular at the time.
Oh, sure.
And it also gave the actors business to do, something to do with their hands, so they wouldn't stand there fidgeting. As far as the drinking, again, it was not something to do with their hands. And it was an activity, drinking, social drinking, apparently before the sunset was a lot more common back in that time than it is now. At least that's what appears to be the case from looking at the films. The extent to which it was an accurate reflection of social customs at the time, I'm not absolutely sure, but I suspect that it probably was, at least to some degree. So as far as the men's behavior and clothing, that was pretty much typical of the day, things that you would see in the real world. But now with the women, it's a completely different story, because it's not only the women's clothing, but the decor of the apartments.
They would have
an apartment where a woman who was working as a secretary, she'd go home to her apartment, and it would be something that today would be $5,000 a month. There were many rooms. They were very large, filled with elegant furniture. Totally unbelievable. But people accepted it because it was a kind of like a wish fulfillment on the part of the viewer. They were imagining a lifestyle that they aspired to, even though they didn't have it themselves. And I guess it didn't really bother them that the degree of opulence and elegance was far beyond what you'd really see. And the same is true of the gowns. A woman would, come home from work and you'd see her making dinner and she'd be wearing an evening gown fit for a fancy nightclub. And they did that because they knew that people just liked to look at elegantly dressed women. So they decided that they would have their costume designers go all out in dressing them in the most beautiful way possible.
Also, I have to say, that's like, I'm an appraiser and I'm in everybody's houses for almost 40 years now. And I study, the built environment, antique, and vintage interior design. And in that period, you've got the kind of the beginnings of the real urbanity in Art Deco, the clean mm-hmm. line, the mirrored surface, and then I think, okay, well, most of the population that's of the United States that's interested in films, they're not living downtown New York or LA. They're, in Kansas or mm-hmm. someplace like this where a deco interior with, mirrors and gorgeous carpeting and a beautiful, sleek shark skin covered for, this would not be seen outside of the films, and likewise the clothing, you just wouldn't see that unless you were, and here it goes back to that urban thing that, this is, and also the lair of the woman, she's got this designed lair. She's got those, the beginning so typical of the, she walked in and she's gorgeous with long legs and she sat at my desk and blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
The hats, of course, for the men. It's interesting. I can remember my grandfather wouldn't go out without a hat.
Exactly. Yeah.
So, but the issue with the hat was that it was such a device because you could wear it so low that the eyes were sort of in shadow, and that became a trope
well. Well, the way you wore the hat would tell a lot about you. If you wore it back, it meant you were kind of jaunty and flirtatious and not too serious. And if you were more straight-laced, you would wear it tipped more forward. And then if you wanted to, as you say, to be mysterious or to hide your face, you could tip it down. But if you wore it at an angle or back, it meant that you were kind of easygoing, lighthearted, possibly flirtatious character.
So, all right. So now 2 seconds to talk a little bit about the narrative voice.
Yes.
So, yeah, I want you to opine on that.
Well, that was very common in film noir. You don't see it in everyone, but you see it much more often in that genre than you would elsewhere. And that is the narrator. And very often it would be a narrator, a male or female, typically male, telling you how they went wrong. They would be talking about how they woke up one day and everything was fine. Their life was good. And then step by step, their lives start to fall apart, usually because of choices that they themselves have made, very Shakespearean in that way. Very often it would start with the narrator in the present day telling you, and the whole movie is basically a flashback telling you how he wound up in prison. Well, you may not even know where he is now in the present when the film begins, but he's telling you his life and where it started and how 5 years ago He led an idyllic life. He was happily married with two kids. And here's what happened to me over the years to bring me to where I am now. That was a very, and that was certainly true in the case of Sunset Boulevard, where he's telling you how he came to be killed, actually, which you don't realize until the end.
And so, also, yeah. It's the style, it's the pattern of speech, and it's the voice that you hear. That, you know, in film noir, it's a. I don't want to say it's not a very educated kind of.
Well, it's the language of the detective novel, really.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. So yeah, it's curt. It's to the point. There's mm-hmm. not a lot of humor. If there's humor, it's dark. It's black humor. It's just sort of depreciating, self-depreciating, and not all that poetic at all. I mean, it's language more of the street, of the cop.
It was very straightforward language that was accessible to anybody watching the films. It was the language they themselves used, but it was crafted because the writers were on staff, and it didn't cost the studios anymore to put them on a B film, which later then became a film noir, or the crime versions did. Some of the writing was very good. And a lot of the writing, by the way, this was the era, especially starting from 1950 onward, this is the era of the blacklist. So a number of the films in the series that we're showing were written actually by blacklisted writers who had to use pseudonyms. Like one of my favorites of the whole bunch is called The Prowler, featuring Van Heflin, who is a really fine actor. And I forget who was credited. It was someone who I think was credited with writing a number of films of that era, but he didn't actually write any of them. The one for The Prowler was actually written by Dalton Trumbo.
Oh, really?
Under his own name, yeah. And the director, Joseph Luzzi, who directed The Prowler, at the time, he wanted to give a little work to his friend Dalton Trumbo. So even though he was blacklisted, he hired him to write the script, and it was presented to, as far as the world knew, the writing had been done by someone who was serving as a front. And ironically, Joseph Luzzi himself, the following year, was himself blacklisted, and he couldn't work anymore. And so that's why a lot of these people, like Jules Dassin, who made the film we talked about before, The Naked City, he was shortly thereafter blacklisted and spent the rest of his career in Europe.
So before we have to go, Steve, I thank you very much for coming on. It's my favorite genre of film. Was there any particular studio that was known? I'm thinking, you know, Dalton Trumbo was really closely associated with Kirk Douglas, for example. And I'm wondering if his own studio, for example, was. I mean, what studio would be the studio?
I'm not sure. I think there were seven major studios at the time, and some minor ones like RKO. RKO was much more. It wasn't as big as sort of like Columbia, Paramount, Universal, but they produced a lot of the film noir. Columbia was very common. You see them as the production house that was responsible for many of these. But I think all of them did it because they all had the pattern of interspersing these B movies with the A movies. And many of them were shot with the themes that later became associated with film noir.
So what RKO in any way associated with British filmmaking?
No, it was an American company.
Okay. So what I'm trying to think of the British film company that kind of caught hold of noir. Maybe that's not included in the series at all, and you haven't researched that, but was there a British studio that...
Yeah, there were some. I've pretty much seen every film noir over the last... starting during the COVID years, 2020 and 2021, my wife and I would watch a film every night. We got tired of watching Netflix and Amazon, so we started watching noir, and we'd see one, sometimes even two a night. And over the next 2 years, I would say we've probably seen almost all of them. And there were some that were made in England at the time that are now considered part of the noir genre, but the overwhelming majority were made in this country.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Steve, for joining us today. Just another shout out, the Ojai Arts Center Theater. It's on Montgomery Street, South Montgomery Street in Ojai. Steve's own series that he will be hosting for 12 consecutive Sundays, starting May 3rd, ending July 26th, and we hope going on after July 26th. And that is very inexpensive, $10 per screening. You get the whole series for $75. Go to www.ojaiartscenter.org. And the curator for this whole series is going to be Steve Grimmett. And I mean, Steve, you were talking about, okay, maybe if this works and it gets legs on it, I wonder if I should be doing the Sunday night films at the theater. So it begs the question, you know, the next thematic, or maybe it won't be thematic. Maybe it'll be chronological. Maybe it'll be something else. But is there another theme that you think of hitting upon?
Well, that's a good question. I thought of that if I do another noir series, I would focus on films that feature female protagonists, not just as femme fatales, but as the actual main protagonist of the film. There are a few that I've already seen, and I might be able to put together a series with just female protagonists, which I think would be quite interesting.
I would love to see you do a series on where the setting becomes a character. So I was thinking of like that you were talking about the interior design. I know that some of the great designers of the period, even in Los Angeles, for example, and the gentleman's escaping my brain now, but there was a lot of very high-end designers that worked in films, but they also designed for, you know, Sinatra. They designed for many of the stars here in L.A., in Santa Barbara, in Palm Springs, but they also did a lot of set work. You know, and this became the language of sophistication in interior design through the films. Mm-hmm. I'd love to see that. I'm thinking of some of the films that I love to see just because I think of the Dorothy Draper, for example, that she was a great designer that also designed for films. I'm thinking of the way, there was a lot of females too, Steve, a lot of female designers that designed the sets for these.
And of course the clothing designers, Edith Head, you know, was some of the.
Adrian. Yeah. So it'd be the look, you know, the material culture of the films. That would be so interesting to me as sort of a junkie on that. But anyway, thank you for coming on. And I can't wait to sit there and hear. And you're going to introduce these films, right? You'll be an active participant?
I'll do a very brief introduction. What I'm hoping to do is to get some film noir experts. I don't actually consider myself an expert in the genre. I mean, I've learned a lot about it over the last few years. But I'm trying to, there are some experts in the surrounding area in Ventura and Santa Barbara, and I'm trying to see if I can get some of them to come to do a Q&A after the film, which I think will be really interesting. But what I'll probably be doing is a brief introduction of each film.
I would think that would be fantastic to get some, even writers that, you know, we've got so many writers that are hiding in the woodpile here in Santa Barbara and in Ojai, Center Ventura, that would be great. Well, thank you for coming on. I appreciate it. Ojai Arts Center Theater invites you to come and see Shadows and Secrets, and then we see where it goes. Let's see where it goes. I'd love to see you continue on with this.
Yes, I intend to.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks, Steve. Bye.
All right. Thank you.